Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Many of the recent acts of violence in America, from mass shootings to the assassination of Charlie Kirk, have been blamed in part on the radicalization of individuals exposed to a kind of extremism that once lurked in the shadows, but which now has emerged without shame online. Fringe ideas have migrated into the mainstream through social networks, algorithms, and memes that push those ideas on both the unsuspecting and those who are seeking them out. This trend has been particularly impactful on young, white men. There is disagreement over which political ideology is responsible for this rising tide of extremism and even violence. The Trump administration is blaming the left, but even the government has pointed the finger at the far right. Until it was recently removed, the Department of Justice website quoted a study that found the number of far-right attacks outpaces all other types of terrorism and domestic violent extremism. That disappeared in the wake of the Kirk assassination. This hour, we look at extremism, at how to define it, at how it is spreading, at why young people are increasingly attracted to it and recruited into this violent ideology, and at what is being done to push back. Pasha Dashgard is Director of Research for the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University in Washington. He's here along with John Lewis, Research Fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University, and Rachel Carroll Rivas is Interim Director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center Action Fund. Good morning to all of you. Welcome to the program.
Morning.
It's radio.
Good morning.
You got to talk.
Good morning.
So, John, I'm going to start with you. I'm not sure which of you to ask this first question of, but I'm going to start with you because you all have all these overlapping areas of expertise. But people with views outside the mainstream have always been with us. They have always found ways to disseminate their ideas. They've always picked up followers. But now the escalation of that spread and the number of people being attracted to these fringe ideas has been on the rise. Is it simply because the internet and social media have made it easy for these ideas to get exposure and to find their way to the people most susceptible to being indoctrinated into those ideas? Or have they been given permission to emerge from the shadows by the current political environment?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a bit of both. Right. Social media is obviously going to lower the barrier to entry. You're not going to see group-based radicalization as the only mechanism there. Right. You don't need to go into the woods, find a militia guy and, you know, get him to teach you everything about anti-government extremism. You can just go on your phone. And so what that's done is just make it so much easier for folks who are looking for that conspiracy, for that, you know, ecosystem of like-minded individuals to further push them down that rabbit hole. And at the same time, we have seen the mainstreaming of so many of those fringe ideas that have made it, again, just so much easier for people to stumble across things like the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which, you know, if you go back, what, eight, nine years, is going to be, you know, a fodder of fringe neo-Nazi forums. Now is, you know, it's hard not to find it on mainstream social media platforms.
John, is this particular to the United States or is this a worldwide phenomenon? And if it's particular to the U.S. or it's more strong in the United States, is that because we have this guaranteed right to free speech?
Yeah, I would say we, as the freest country in the world, have certainly created a fertile ground for a lot of the forms of extremism that would more easily be tamped down on in other countries. But, you know, I would say, especially when you look at the global far right, this is an inherently transnational set of movements here. You know, you have aesthetics, you have conspiracies, you have narratives that transcend state boundaries, transcend national boundaries, and allow for that rising tide of fascism, of violent extremism to really lift all boats here.
I think both Rachel and Pasha want to get in. Go ahead, Rachel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would add that I think it's the speed for me. Quite frankly, I've spent, 20 years mostly on the ground with communities dealing with hate incidents, radicalization, extremism in rural places. But the speed of online radicalization just changes the game. I'll give you an example. We did a study last year looking at online mass shooter videos and used a software to track them in 20 different platforms online. Over that 5-year period where these shootings had since occurred, things like Christchurch shootings, so speaking of transnational issues, we found that in that 5 years, there we found 15,000 videos still remaining online from these mass shootings. This was after, there had been an attempt to pull them down by some of these platforms. But 12,000 of the videos that were posted online in the wake of the Christchurch shooting were posted within 24 hours.
Wow.
That is an unbelievable statistic.
Let me ask a question about that, because the Charlie Kirk assassination video is the single most graphic thing I think I've ever seen. I haven't gone looking for them in the past, but when it happened, I just happened to go through Instagram, I think it was, and there it was in very graphic detail, Pasha. When you are able to see that, and you can try to take that down, but somebody's going to put it back up. When you see that, what impact does that have, both on those who would push people toward extremism and those who are susceptible to seeing things like that? What does it do to them, for them?
Yeah, so part of my research when I was in my doctoral program was with Roxy Silver and the Silver Stress Lab, where we actually studied the effects of consuming traumatizing media on mental health. And we know that seeing blood, fire, smoke, explosions, gore, these things are potentially traumatizing, especially depending on how much of this content you're consuming. So I remember we did a study where we found that if you watched a certain amount of 9/11 coverage, you indicated trauma symptoms on the same level of people who were in New York on 9/11. So, if there is a person in your life or people in your life who are, incredibly like hurt and grieving the loss of Charlie Kirk, and they're watching these videos and they're online, they're watching the assassination video over and over again, this can have a serious impact on your mental health and can even prompt post-traumatic stress.
Which
I would
brings us
say,
to what happened yesterday, and we don't know very much about what happened yesterday or the perpetrator that was responsible for the church shooting and fire in Grand Blanc, Michigan, where he drove his truck in, allegedly drove his truck into a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints church, fired on the congregants, set the church on fire. We don't know much about that, but seeing the end result, which has been all over commercial television, is that a trigger for some people?
absolutely. And what we know is that trauma is a vulnerability factor for radicalization. So this is all part of the same sort of problem, and that we see that there is copycat crimes where once somebody does something like this, they prompt other people who are sub-threshold, who are sort of not there yet, but are like in that realm of sadness, desperation, anger, grievance, and this can absolutely push people over the edge. It's frankly shocking to me. I feel like even 4 or 5 years ago, the media had a better policy around not showing these kinds of videos, taking these videos down when they're on social media, not talking about the shooter, not identifying them by name, centering the victims. And it feels like those standards that were hard won have been pulled back. And I don't know to what end. I don't know how this benefits anyone that all of us were able to see the manifesto from the Minnesota shooter as he's posting it on Twitter, and this guy seeing Charlie Kirk get assassinated on our social media feeds. Like, how does this benefit anybody? How is this making anybody's lives better?
So, John, there's always been extremism. I can remember when I was a kid hearing conspiracy theories, and I heard about extremists publishing newspapers and leaflets and sending them out. But now it's everywhere because it's online and it's ubiquitous. We witnessed the Tiki Torch March through Charlottesville several years ago, where ideas being espoused by the people on the march would have been abhorrent and would have ostracized those individuals instantly in the past. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Is this simply because all of this is being fomented online and by the very act of that happening being mainstreamed?
Yeah, that, you know, you certainly can't overlook how important it is when you have mainstream individuals, elected officials, people with massive platforms, right? When you have a million followers on Twitter, when you have that blue check, that gold check, it gives that veneer of legitimacy, right? So it's not just the neo-Nazi espousing this, but it's your elected official, your congressperson, your attorney general. And I think what we've seen in recent years is just, you know, that casual embrace of extremely dehumanizing, you know, the us versus them culture war rhetoric. I think that, you know, that obviously goes so far beyond these narrow ideologies, right? These culture war grievances, the idea that we cannot exist without doing something against the other, against that outgroup. You know, that unfortunately in recent years has become a very casually accepted trend that I think has radicalized, you know, a lot of people, not just left, not just right, but your average American who would not be someone that we would label a terrorist or a violent extremist, but your neighbor, my neighbor, the people who went to January 6th, they truly thought in that moment that they were saving the country, they were taking this country back. And those deeply emotive, those deeply emotional messages, unfortunately, continue to have an effect on the population.
This is insidious, it seems to me, Pasha, because algorithms are responsible for much of this. You may not be seeking out this content, but perhaps you stumble on it and you watch it, and that tells the algorithm, I'm interested in this, and so it feeds you something else very much like that, and it continues on and on and on until the other kind of message that you might be getting is never seen, because the algorithm is simply feeding you what it thinks you want. Right. But somebody is creating this content. Do we know who the creators of this content are?
Sure. They're very loud about who they are. Very easy to find. This is the thing, is that this is an industry, right? And I'm going to say that this is not new either, right? There's always been a sort of contingent of people who make money by ginning up grievance on their political side to sort of, you know, make a sell books or sell a, in this case, a brand. And so this is really where this is different, is that because of social media and because of how many sites, platforms, and apps offer people opportunities to make a name for themselves, there is a whole sort of incentive structure for these guys to come in and tell people, hey, if you know, go to my website and you take my workshops, I'll show you how to get girls. I'll show you how to, you know, get rich. I'll show you how to be powerful and famous and successful. And they're selling, often young men, this kind of myth that you can be this ideal masculine man if you only listen to me, if you only buy my products. And so we see this in like 10 different ways. Sometimes it's dating and relationship advice. Sometimes it's like workout and fitness, where there's a thing called looks maxing, where like somebody's going to tell you, oh, you know, you need your jaw to be this shape, and so, you know, chew my gum and that's going to make your jaw really strong or whatever. And so there's a whole set of people who are happy to make profit and make a name for themselves by fulfilling this.
And young men seem to be particularly susceptible to this. And when we come back, we'll talk about that with Rachel Carroll Rivas, Intelligence Director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center, John Lewis, and Pasha Dashkar from GW and American Universities. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at Mazda of South Charlotte. Dot com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about extremism, the rise of extremism, the mainstreaming of it through social media and other means with Pasha Dashkar, Director of Research of Polarization and Extremism in the Research and Innovation Lab at American University. It's a big title. John Lewis is a research fellow in the program on extremism at George Washington University, and Rachel Carroll Rivas is the Intelligence Director of the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center and their Action Fund. Rachel, this appears to be very effective, or maybe most effective, among young people, particularly young men. Is that because young people have less experience in the world? They're more naive, they're more open to new ideas and experiences, because they spend more time online, perhaps, than their older counterparts, and therefore are more exposed to this? Or is something else at work?
Oh, I think there's a few factors here that make youth more susceptible. And definitely the amount of time spent online is one factor. And so when we look at variations between age, that definitely plays a role. But I do think something that both John and Pasha said is really important here, that this is an age-old recipe, right? This is an age-old recipe for how to get it done. When conspiracies particularly, and part of it is that claiming of an access to a higher truth. Pasha mentioned this, right? Like, they know something that other people don't know. Another is just relying on existing bigotries and bias that people have in the world. Now, and that is sort of part of our society. So if that is bigotries and bias about women or people of color or LGBTQ folks, sort of relying on those stereotypes. I think the other is this, you know, idea that there is a dualism, that there is just right and wrong, black and white, that there is one answer and another. And I think the other piece for me, really, that I've seen online and off is in, you know, as we call it, in real life, although online seems pretty in real life these days for a lot of folks, is just this sense that they're going to give people answers, simple answers to complex questions. Yeah. And for the world, there's a lot of complex questions now. People are hurting. They don't know how to deal with what's going on in the world. They may have economic anxieties. They may have relationship anxieties. They may have political anxieties about the status of the world. And this simple answer to these very complex questions is highly appealing and always has been. But particularly when you sort of are in that status where you're in a big transition, or if you're a youth that haven't had that experience, when someone offers you something that's an answer, why wouldn't you grab it? I mean, I feel like it's a very natural thing to do. So this is, I think, a formula that has existed for a long time. And the challenge is, I think, really how we interrupt it. Because if we're in person and we're seeing it happen in our neighborhood or at our coffee shop, you know, there's that opportunity to kind of engage and to interject. I think that we have this issue with online radicalization where we're not actually always right there in the moment. Now, we can be. People are in those spaces. They're right. They're on Facebook Live together. They're in chat rooms together. There are opportunities for us to interject, but sometimes it's hard to figure out exactly what do you do? What do you say?
Pasha.
Mike, I just want to add to that. So could not agree more with what Rachel was saying, though I will say, as a sort of director of research for a prevention lab, often the reason that we're working with youth is because it's easier to work with youth, and not because older adults are not also vulnerable to radicalization. If you looked at, for example, the people who were showing up on January 6th, it wasn't all young people. It was middle-aged people as well. It was older adults as well. And this is an issue where it's harder to work with older adults because you can't appeal to, like, a teacher or a parent or some sort of guardian or authority figure in their life, but they're also being radicalized. You know, I think about my parents need digital media literacy as much as my kids do, right? And so it's like anybody, plausibly anyone on this call, anyone our age could be vulnerable to conspiracy theories, misinformation, and recruitment.
And before the program started, John, we talked about how military veterans are often susceptible to this, or at least targeted by this kind of activity. Are they targeted, or are they more susceptible? And in either case, why?
Yeah, so, you know, I think logically it fits this pattern that we see, especially with, you know, white supremacist anti-government extremism, which is looking for people who have military experience, have weapons training, have familiarity in that sort of rigid rules-based structure. When you look at groups like the Oath Keepers, movements in that anti-government space, what they will often do is really just wrap themselves in this twisted, warped version of the American flag. And they will tell, again, veterans, active duty service members, they will say, we are a continuation of your oath. You love the Constitution. We love the Constitution. We are just upholding those exact same values. And it's not until you get a couple meetings in, you get deeper and deeper, then you start talking about, well, which laws are constitutional? We're the ones that have to decide what is and isn't right. And then it quickly descends into anti-government extremism. But, you know, there has been, unfortunately, this sustained insider threat when we talk about how extremist groups are targeting veterans, looking to recruit them and pull them deeper into those rabbit holes.
Pasha.
Mike, I just want to add on to what John was saying there, that the part where what John was saying about they don't lead with the extremism. So this is a thing that we saw with active clubs and sort of like combat gyms in white supremacist circles as well, where the new strategy for a lot of white supremacist recruitment is don't talk about the Jews, don't talk about the history. You lead with brotherhood, community, and then identity, in quotes. And so this is again, as Rachel was saying, a tried and true practice of like, you don't lead with, hey, we're an extremist group and we'd like you to join. You lead by offering people things that they are lacking in their life, whether it's community, sense of purpose, a sense of camaraderie or something bigger than yourself. And then you, as you pull them in, that's when you start introducing the rhetoric, the hate speech, the sort of supremacist ideology.
Rachel, did you want to add to that?
I think both John and Pasha, you know, just spot on here. In addition, I just don't think that we can ignore that one of the kind of factors that we're dealing with here is that while people to get power have to join together, right? They can inflict fear and they can change society by an individual action. And we have seen that by these acts of mass violence, by these acts of political violence. But for power, you need numbers, you need people. And so that can look like, you know, narrative and really a specific message or conspiracy that can spread online. But, you know, at the end of the day, there is also a joining together in person. And either way, if you join together in person with your militia in North Carolina, because you've been told online, you got to show up in the face of this natural disaster to, you know, step in for the government, or if you inflict an act of mass violence as an individual, I will say either way, we are dealing with a scenario where guns matter and they make a difference. And so we live in a more armed society than other. And that is also a factor that's changing the fact that if you're radicalized online and you also have access to a lot of high power guns, you're gonna do more damage.
Well, that's going to be my next question, which is worse, because whenever we have one of these acts of mass violence, which usually involve guns, and they are every day now, they're not once every year or 5 or 10, and the world used to stop when they occurred, they're every day, and we don't even notice, we move on with our lives. And when they happen, the conversation usually turns toward guns and the fact that we have a Second Amendment, so we can't take the guns away, we can't regulate the guns, etc. But should the conversation really be pivoted toward radicalization, can we tie the increase in violence, Rachel, not to guns, but to young people who are having their heads filled with ideas that simply lead them to this and are not true?
I think both. I think the reality is both. We see that there, you know, is radicalization that is problematic on an individual level, that has mass societal impact that does not involve weapons. And we see a number of incidents, as you just said, that absolutely affect society and large number of people's people that are using guns. So we know about the mass shootings. We know about the school violence with guns. We know about the impact that guns have on public debate. I think one of my favorite phrases is really that democracy doesn't happen at a barrel of a gun, because no one feels safe and you can't feel safe to say anything or to do anything. So yes to guns, but also we have online spaces, and there's new data coming out about how unbelievably horrible these spaces are, particularly Gore, those spaces that are being recruited by what we don't fully understand in radicalized ideologies that are targeting girls particularly. And the targeting of girls, the numbers are staggering. The number of victims of groups like that, you know, Order of Nine Angels and some of these groups that are online that some people are calling something nihilistic, violent extremism. The point is, not a really firm ideology that we can understand, but a following of extremist spaces, very radicalized space online. And those victims are just as numerous, and they're individual, and they're mostly female.
When in the wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination, John, J.D. Vance hosted his show and made this statement, quote, "It is a statistical fact that most of the lunatics in American politics today are proud members of the far left." It's the vice president saying that. But according to the Anti-Defamation League, more than 70% of all extremist attacks and domestic terrorist plots since 2002 in the United States have been perpetrated by those on the right. The majority were by white supremacists, but others on the right are anti-government or anti-Islamist, anti-you name it. Yet Donald Trump has declared war on those on the left, particularly Antifa, which is not an organization. It's an idea. According to the Anti-Defamation League, those with left-leaning ideologies are responsible for very few incidents. Can we trust those Anti-Defamation League numbers? Do you have any of your own?
I would certainly point to the consensus in the research space, which does align with those ADL stats, which does show that in recent years, certainly, that the violent attacks, the deadly attacks have predominantly come from the far right. But again, you know, just building on what Rachel was talking about here, you know, this is an inherently American problem, right? That this is our own version of homegrown terrorism. It's not illegal to be an extremist in the US, for better or worse. It's not illegal to stockpile weapons and hold views that you or I might think
but
are.
It might be illegal to be extremist on the left if Donald Trump has his way.
And I think that speaks to the challenge that we face here with the politicization of this, right? I think, you know, if you go back 10 years, you know, you look at a group like the Islamic State, right? You have a pretty bipartisan agreement that if you support ISIS, you should not be in government, should not be in law enforcement, should not be in the military. The homegrown threat that we have here, predominantly on the right, a bit on the left as well, but, you know, also just increasingly non-ideological, it takes on a very American face, right? It doesn't fit the preconceived notions of what terrorism looks like, should look like. I think that's really allowed this threat to fester. But again, at the same time, it can't be an either or, right? We can't just focus on one element of this. And that obviously does not make us safer as a country.
A lot of the messages that seem to be resonating with some people are white supremacist messages, Christian nationalist messages. And there are those who say that that is the basis of the MAGA movement, and that Donald Trump and others in his administration are part of that movement. Is that taking it a step too far? I'm not sure who to ask that question of.
I think when you look at the mainstreaming of the threat, you can certainly draw distinctions between mainstream figures, elected officials, politicians, predominantly on the right, who have embraced and allowed those more extreme ideas to seep into our political consciousness. And I think that obviously, as we've seen, is going to have tremendous second and third order effects. Again, when you have a vice president, when you have a president who are promoting such virulent us versus them language, that's going to send a message that's going to embolden, you know, the lone actor, the guy who's looking for justification for violence, even if it's not movement or group based.
And you don't have to go online for that. All you have to do is follow the news on a daily basis, it seems to me. Yes, there are dog whistles and code words being used that perhaps people in these fringe groups recognize while the rest of us don't. But there are also other phrases being used, like referring to immigrants as invaders, attacking diversity, Donald Trump's pardoning of the January 6th insurrectionists, and the decision to clamp down on those now who fund left-wing causes. All of that, to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rachel, is that this extremism has made its way firmly into the mainstream. Has it?
Yeah. Don't our words escape us sometimes? I think the word extreme in and of itself is a little challenging. It implies something in the minority, and it implies something that is outside of, right, the majority of people. But for really, for most types of definitions that people like us who work in this space think about, you know, it really is about that othering and that use of othering to, you know, to explain problems of the world and by force, particularly that there is this other. And I think that's really for me where I see that we have this cross between understanding radicalization extremism and also understanding democracies and understanding what thriving democracies look like and what failing democracies look like. And right now, I think those people that are democracy experts are saying that we're on the edge. We're on the edge of a failing democracy, and that is because of extremist thinking, othering thinking, and because of the radicalization of the population of our nation, but also the population of the people who are in power. And if we have people in power, like the president, who over the weekend uplifted the great replacement theory, this is a conspiracy theory that is not true, right? A conspiracy theory that there is an elite group of people who are manipulating the system to their benefit. And that manipulation is particularly by bringing more people of color, of immigrants, to the nation to become voters and to then corrupt the voting system. This is not true. People have to be citizens to vote. They have to go through the process. There is no Jewish conspiracy controlling the Democratic Party that is bringing people here to change the demographics of the country to vote. That isn't true. And it is based on a false anti-Semitic and racist conspiracy theory. And so absolutely, we have a problem with leaders of all kinds, business leaders, faith leaders, and political leaders of parties who are uplifting the ideas and the faces, as Pasha mentioned earlier, the people that are the figures that are radicalizing people online and are radicalizing youth to our future, which means that our democracy is even more at risk.
I have 10 seconds. Does that mean we're spending the morning concentrating on the platforms that are permeating this culture, but it's escaped the platforms. It's now in the White House. So are we looking at the wrong thing? You can't get an answer to that question in the time allotted. So we'll come back and talk about that and other aspects of this in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at HabitatCharlotteRegion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about extremism and the spaces that seem to foment and encourage it and recruit people into various extremist ideologies with Pasha Dashgar, Director of Research for the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University. Rachel Carol Rivas is Interim Director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center Action Fund. And John Lewis is a Research Fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. Pasha, your work focuses on how white supremacist ideologies are spreading online and how fringe online communities have created and disseminated these ideologies in male-centered spaces. What spaces are being used to spread these thoughts, and why are they so attractive to young men?
So, great question. I would say, first of all, our research looks at all supremacist ideologies and is looking at conspiracy theories, misinformation, propaganda, kind of any persuasion that is meant to foment political division or social division. We look at a lot of online spaces. We look at sort of the fringe you know, alt-right, alt-tech platforms, these spaces that are unmoderated and, you know, highly toxic. But we also look at sort of mainstream platforms, and we look at the way that those narratives that are built in those fringe spaces sort of trickle up or get pulled into these mainstream platforms. So, you know, we look at, I don't know, 4chan and 8kun and all of these. I don't even want to name them because I don't want to give them more sort of visibility. But we look at bad places on the internet. Go, if you look at perilresearch.com and you look at our resources, we have all sorts of resources for parents, caregivers, teachers, educators, community members, faith leaders. All of them should be able to understand sort of what are the red flags and warning signs, what are the problematic online spaces, and then our tools also give them skills so they can have those conversations and engage to prevent young people from going down those rabbit holes.
I know, Rachel, you wanted to talk about interruption of these, how to stop these messages or to intervene with somebody who seems to be going down the rabbit hole. How easy is that to do? When does it have to be done to be effective? And if you've already crossed over, can you bring that person back?
It's an incredible question. And I will say, the world of what de-radicalization space is probably one of the most challenging, right? It is very difficult because people have then surrounded themselves with folks who think like them and who are acting on those thoughts like them. And so it's very difficult. When you're in that, and this is why we focus so much on prevention, because when you're in that moment in which you're not fully surrounded and you actually have people around you, parents, coaches, ministers, you know, club leaders or friends, right? If we're talking about adults, the friend at the coffee shop, whoever it might be, clubs, those are the people really that are going to help someone exit out of these spaces. Or that they're beginning to enter and radicalize because they're trusted. Those trusted messengers are key. And I think the first and foremost step really is, to Pasha's point, the recognition that something is happening. So as a parent, that looks like not just hovering to be there at any moment, all the time, and never let a kid do anything, but it also doesn't look like so permissive that I have no idea. It's really about that engagement level of understanding, is there a behavior that's changed? Is there a content they're accessing that's different? Do I know what that content is? I think a really good example for me is that I spend, you know, time with my team in some really gross spaces, and particularly white supremacists, anti-Semitic folks, use some tools that are kind of like a random generator of video with someone else. And there's companies like OME TV and Monkey, et cetera, that have used these, and youth can access them like that. And they're targeted with disgusting messages. And if a parent doesn't even know what that website is, then you've lost the battle right there. So it requires a lot of self-education, and we provide tools for that. Our colleagues do at other organizations. Just what is it that my kid might be looking at?
A lot of people on the left, Pasha, and on the right, feel that the system is broken, that it no longer works for them. In fact, it's working against them. And many young men apparently are awash in a sea of uncertainty over what their role as men in this society happens to be. According to the State of American Men 2025, men are in crisis today because of what they lack. And that is putting them on a fast track to radicalization. Is that how you view it?
It is. And it speaks, Mike, I think, to your question earlier about sort of the political nature of this. I really think so much of this is like, it's, I won't say apolitical, but that we sort of over-index on ideology, when oftentimes what's happening is that people are committing mass violence events because they are, frankly, desperate, with horrible mental health. They are feeling they don't have any other options. They're feeling, in some ways, you could understand mass shooting events as like suicide by cop. That is one plausible way to interpret what happens here. And it's not surprising to me, for example, that the Michigan shooter also died during this. That's mostly how this goes. And I think that when you think about it in those terms, then you start thinking about like, Well, people are feeling a lack of trust in institutions. People are feeling a lack of economic stability. People are seeing that social services are being stripped away. And so they're closer and closer to living paycheck to paycheck or living right above desperation and sort of disaster. And those things really perpetuate radicalization.
So if we know this about young men who are facing this crisis of identity and their purpose in the world, what they're supposed to be doing, and we also have these young men who feel forgotten and ignored, mm-hmm. who believe that they can't get a job, they can't buy a house, they can't find a girlfriend, they can't earn enough money to be the breadwinner, which is still a key element of masculinity. Are we spending too much time worrying about these people spending time on the internet and being recruited as opposed to working to help them through this crisis?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the answer is definitely both, right? These things are playing into each other. Mike, you stumbled on the whole sort of language and literature of radicalization here. It's like what you were talking about, what I was just talking about, those are preconditions. Those are vulnerabilities. Those are factors that can push people. And then when they hit some sort of time of their life where they're feeling untethered, where they're feeling desperate, where they got divorced or they lost a job or some tragedy happens, when you have those preconditions and then you have the tragedy, and then you layer on top of that what they're seeing on the internet, what they're consuming on their social media feeds, that's where you get the sort of horrible, toxic brew that leads to mass violent events.
So we seem to have extremists on both sides of the political spectrum, although according to all the figures, most of them doing the worst damage, I suppose, are the extremists on the right. But they are not a monolith, John. There are Christian nationalists who tell us that the nation was founded on Christian principles and somehow that equates to white dominance. There are techno-authoritarians, I just learned this term yesterday, who are the tech bros who believe that democracy has failed us and should be replaced by something resembling a corporation with orders coming from on high. There are those who believe that society is beyond saving and that its collapse must be hastened. And there are those who advocate violence against the government and other institutions. Do we know which of these is taking up the most space online, which seems to be more attractive to young people who are in desperate straits and are looking for change?
It's never going to be one or the other. And I think to echo everything that Rachel and Pasha said, people just need to touch grass, right? Like, I think at the end of the day, right, like, you know, it's not just a black and white case of, you know, we have to turn people who are becoming radicalized into perfect American citizens in some way. It's about disengagement, I think, in a lot of these cases. These are deeply personal pathways they go on. A lot of these individuals are not necessarily deep thinkers. They're not ideologues, right? They are angry. They are confused. They are alone. They are lost. They are looking for, like Rachel has talked about, those answers, that meaning, that significance. And because the ideology is playing less of a prominent role, it's you can't just try and turn that ideology off, right? So it is looking at the root causes of what's pushing those people down those rabbit holes and disengaging them from that. But certainly, you know, I think the challenge here is that, again, because of the work of organizations like SPLC and Peril in the past, we don't have these monolithic organizations that are just, you know, like the Klan, that are pushing everyone down that same rabbit hole in the exact same way. Because you have this hodgepodge, amorphous, decentralized, just bottom-up, very online set of radicalization pathways, it becomes a choose-your-own-adventure game, effectively. And so because of that, it is Christian nationalism, it is accelerationism, it is, you know, so many of these isms. But I think it's understanding what's pushing folks down that rabbit hole instead of trying to pull them out at the very end.
So
Mike,
the country,
I would love to add something for that.
Sure.
I think it's still important to know that while these phenomenons may be sort of understandable from a psychological perspective, they are still often intentional. The reality is that we have people who were leaders in the far right white supremacist movement in the United States who came up with many of the ideas of how this is playing out today. Thomas Metzger, one of the leaders of the white supremacist movement in the United States, called for a leaderless resistance and actually coined the term lone wolf, which now we have media use as if it's a real thing. But the reality is this was an intentional effort to get people to act so that they couldn't hold the Klan responsible for their actions, because groups like SPLC was suing the Klan for what their members were doing. And quite frankly, Metzger saw that there was an opportunity to do a narrative campaign, to spread rhetoric, to inspire people to go out and act. And he said this would be a leaderless resistance to escape legal accountability, and there would be lone wolves out there doing this work. This is what we see. This is what we see every single day, to your point, Mike, right now. But at the same time, we have two other things happening. We have pressures from groups that are actually organized, putting pressure on those individuals and online, and putting pressure on politics to act. I'm going to give you a quote from Arik Ontario over the weekend. He said, "You don't want the US to show up. The FBI and DHS are a lot nicer than we are. So shut the up and clean up your cities. You won't like it when the B team rolls in." So this is the power of a group that is someone using online space, in this case, X, a huge platform, to inspire people to join up in a group that inspired actions like January 6th that Tario was part of organizing. And then we do actually have a monolith, to your point, Mike, when we have a political figure, political leaders that are trying to actually put everyone in a big bucket and lead them. The pressures are intense on people, and the pressures are intense on youth.
We may not need those ex officio organizations like the Proud Boys, because the country is moving, inarguably, I think, into an authoritarian direction. We are witnessing a lot of the same messages being adopted that have been used in the past to take other nations down authoritarian roads. We are witnessing the rise of Christian nationalism. We are watching the rise of an oligarchy increasingly taking control of the levers of power and owning vaster and vaster swaths of our media universe. Is this coming to pass, John, because of the economic realities that have developed over the last 50 years, or because people are being radicalized online by bad actors who have long had their eye on these fundamental changes in American society? What's happening here? Why is this happening? No one's even talking about it. People, it's happening. We're like the frog in the boiling pot of water here.
Yeah, and look, you know, I think that's the nature of this threat, right? It's because it is so insidious, because for years and years it has been the call coming from inside the house, right? And I think especially when we look at the post 9/11 terrorism landscape, right? I think we, as a government, as a country, conceptualize terrorism as the thing that comes from overseas and the people who don't look like us, who hate us because they hate our freedom and democracy and apple pie and baseball. And I think that, you know, it's difficult for us to look in the mirror and recognize that when the call comes from inside the house, when it's our neighbors, our friends, someone who mowed my mom's lawn, right? Those are terrorists. That is the American form of extremism that has taken hold in this country. And I think that it's all those factors, right? It is social, it is economical, it is psychological, it is the mainstreaming of these threats, it is the acceleration of, you know, this flash to bang because of social media. I don't think you can point the finger at any one of those things, because it is such a diverse and wicked problem.
So I have less than 2 minutes left. And Pasha, I know that American University's Polarization and Extremism Research Innovation Lab, or PERL, and the Southern Poverty Law Center have been working together to prevent this kind of online radicalization. What approaches seem to work?
Yeah, so we take a very upstream approach. There is a lot of people doing a lot of work across this sort of spectrum, but to me, in my mind, as a former therapist, I can tell you that prevention in this space is worth 10 pounds of cure. It is scalable, it is deliverable to a wide group of people, and it is much easier to stop people from going down that path than to pull people up. And so the way that PERL and SPLC have sort of worked together to approach this is you take plausibly any trusted adults in the life of a young person, and you equip all of them with knowledge and skills to be able to engage with young people on the topic of radicalization without shutting down the topic, without making them defensive, that closing off future conversations. And if you can get, in the therapeutic terms, a continuity of care between parents at home, teachers at school, mental health professionals, then you have a firm basis to prevent radicalization.
Pasha Dashgard is Director of Research for the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University in Washington. He was joined this morning by John Lewis, Research Fellow at the Program for Extremism at George Washington University, and Rachel Carol Rivas, Interim Director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center Action Fund. Clearly, there are professionals working on this, recognizing this as a problem. We wish you the best of luck. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.